This is the Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nadeau. Thanks for spending some of your time with us today. We are talking with author Ron Rindo about his latest book, Life and Death and Giants. Ron is an emeritus professor of English and creative writing at UW Oshkosh. He's published one previous novel, which we talked about a few years back, Breathing Lake Superior. He's also written three short story collections. And as we talked to Ron, we want to hear from you. So let us know why you love Ron's writing. What have you read Life and Death and Giants? What do you think about it? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Ron, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back, Joe. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure because this book is wonderful, and I don't just say that. So,
well, thank you.
It really, really is good. And let's start off with the title of your book, okay?
Yes.
This is from a poem from Emily Dickinson, and you've got her poetry kind of sprinkled around throughout the book. What is it about her poetry that moved you to put it in the book, and specifically the title, especially?
Right. So I have loved Emily Dickinson for most of my career. I have taught her poetry at various levels in English classes. And it's just something that I wanted to engage with in this book. And so Hannah, the main character, one of the main characters, she is an Amish grandmother who, up until the point where she encounters Emily Dickinson's poetry, has only read religious texts, specifically the Bible. And when she discovers this collected book of Emily Dickinson poems in her mother's trunk after her mother passes away, it's what begins her journey into the secular world, into the world of culture. And it's the first step, and she's entranced by it. And what entrances her is pretty much the same thing that has entranced me about Emily Dickinson, is that it's the way in which she covers so many different subjects. And her poems, particularly for Hannah's purposes, her poems about faith and doubt. And that really is what Hannah zeroes in on, and she finds it just entrancing, and she just cannot stop digging into that trunk and getting that book out, particularly at moments in her life that are, that she finds challenging.
Very comforting for her.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
And is part of that because it's her mother who cherished it?
Yes. And what's wonderful for Hannah is her mother has written little comments and notes. And so those are the poems that she seeks out because she knows her mother in one way. She knows her mother's outside life, but she hasn't had that in-depth exposure to her mother's inside life, you know, the intimate interior life. And she's both shocked and really happy to be able to encounter that because she's someone who's also very introspective as a character, as a person.
Sure. Let's tell us the kind of the overview of the book itself before we get too far into it, so people kind of know what we're talking about.
Sure. So Life and Death and Giants, it's centered on a young Amish boy who was born into this small community called Lakota, Wisconsin. It's based on Dakota, Wisconsin, a place that I have trout fished many, many times in my life on the McCann River. And there are four characters who tell the story of this young boy who is born into this community, and he grows up ultimately to be just under 9 feet tall, and he weighs 600 pounds. He is based upon, his growth is based upon the largest human being who's ever been recorded, a man named Robert Wadlow, who lived in the 1930s and 40s. He's also known as the Alton Giant. He grew to be 9 feet tall, 600 pounds. He had size 37 feet. But unlike Gabriel in the book, who is very talented athletically, Robert Wadlow, because of his large size, he had to wear leg braces and he had lots of physical problems. He worked for the circus for a while. He also worked as a representative for a shoe company that custom made his size 37 shoes. But he, one of the braces rubbed against his ankle and he got an infection and he died at the age of 22 of that infection. So that's where the initial idea for the story came from. In this story, then, Gabriel's life is told by four different narrators. The main one, I think, was probably his Amish grandmother, Hannah Fisher, who helps to raise him for a portion of his life. Then there's the veterinarian named Thomas Kennedy, who delivers him from his dying mother. He weighs 18 pounds when he's born, and he's 27 inches long. So he's very, very
large.
And
he basically bursts out of his mother.
Yes, yes. He has to use a lambing snare to pull him from his mother's body. And then there's a football coach by the name of Trey Beathard, who has come up from Texas, and he coaches his high school football team, and ultimately he is the person that brings Gabriel out of the sort of safety of the Amish community and into the wider world as a football star. And then finally, there's Billy Walton, who is the owner of a local sports bar, who coaches Gabriel in Little League. He sponsors a Little League team, and he's a sports fanatic. And a little salty in his language and his view of the world, and somewhat provides some of the comic relief. But those are the four characters who tell Gabriel's story from birth and until the end of the book.
One thing I really wanted to ask you as I was reading through this. So three of the narrators are in first person, but the veterinarian is not. So why did you do that, Ron?
Yes, that's a very good question. So one of the pleasures of writing short stories is you get to create these voices and you inhabit this first person who can be very different than you are. And that's certainly true for the three narrators in this story. For Thomas, for the veterinarian, I also needed a little extra room to be omniscient. So even in the prologue, it's in Thomas's point of view, but there are moments when the narrator has to sort of tell the story of the larger town or some of the other characters and so forth. And so I needed that extra space. And I worried about that just a little bit, but really with a couple of exceptions, no one has really, said too much about that being a problem.
It's not a problem, but it was a question.
It is, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It was deliberate, but it's definitely something that I think it's wise to notice.
Well, I try. So now let's talk about this, the inspiration that you had for this. I love the fact that you write in the beginning that you kind of had this idea in your head, but it just wasn't gelling.
Yes.
So what did it take?
Yeah, so I was reading about Robert Wadlow one day sitting at my desk eating lunch. And
As one does.
And I was trying to figure out, I wanted to write a story about a giant in 21st century America. And so I wrote a version of the prologue. The version in the book is about the fifth draft right now. But, the birth scene and this giant is born. But there were two problems. One, I didn't really know where the story was going to go. That was the main thing. Like, okay, so you're going to have a giant. I suspected if you're going to be 9 feet tall today, you would probably play sports of some kind. And so I kind of knew all that. But one of the stickier points that it bothered me was I didn't think it would be possible for someone to become a giant today, because medical intervention would have made that, they could treat it, right? Any kind of pituitary problem. And so I was fishing on the McCann River, and an Amish buggy went by, and I had written this prologue probably 2 or 3 years earlier. It was just sitting in a file, and I had moved on to other short stories or working on some other things. And an Amish buggy went by. You see a lot of Amish buggies in that part of the state, and for some reason, it made me start thinking again about this novel. And I thought, well, if this young boy was born into an Amish community where they don't necessarily vaccinate their children or go to the doctor on a regular basis, remember the big measles outbreak in Texas was started in a Mennonite community for the same reason. So I went back to it then. I thought, okay, this person is going to be Amish. And then, of course, serendipitously, other things started to unfold, and that was one of the main tensions in the book, which is between the secular life and the spiritual life,
right,
and the desire to live a life devoted to community and humility and just the quiet sort of life of an Amish person versus the American quest for individual fame and fortune, mm-hmm. which is going to find you if you become 9 feet tall. And
they
that's going to be
it.
Spread around the world via social media. And so it solved one problem, and it also introduced the main sort of thematic thread that runs mm-hmm. through the book.
And I just realized that Hannah's last name is Fisher. Was that intentional?
That's my mother's maiden name.
Oh, okay.
And it's also a fairly prominent Amish name as well.
It is. Well, that works out really well.
It did.
So let's talk about another name, which is the name of this giant, which is Gabriel. Mm-hmm. Very biblical in background. Did you do that on purpose, too?
I did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did on purpose. His mother is Amish, but she has been cast away from her community for bearing a child out of wedlock and for not naming the father and refusing to name the father. That causes a lot of angst for her mother, obviously, who is separated from her daughter and not able to attend to the birth of her first child, who is Jasper Fisher. And when he's 17 is when she delivers, when she gives birth to Gabriel. So Hannah, even though Rachel has been cast out of her community, she's still a woman of deep faith. And so she names her son Gabriel.
Uh-huh. And yeah, he's definitely a messenger, right?
Yes, he is.
Yes, he is. When you do names, obviously you said this was your mother's last name, and how important is it to you that it's not that you just like the name, but that it has some kind of underlying meaning, not only to you, but to one of the readers?
I think sometimes, probably most times, I think that's true. So for an example, Billy Walton, the name of the bar owner, that's actually the name of my great uncle, who was not a bar owner. He was a butcher, but he had a very extensive bar in his basement. And he spoke a lot like Billy Walton in this novel. He's long passed away. So that's an example of that.
Sure.
The name Thomas's mother's name is my own mother's name, Dorothy. So sometimes I use names that are familiar. Mm-hmm. My three granddaughters' names are in the book as well. Sometimes I just drop names in like that for fun.
We can't help that.
Gabriel and then Raphael, those are both important names, and they're drawn from the biblical.
Yes, which makes sense. We are talking with Ron Rindo. He's the author of Life and Death and Giants. Do you have any questions about the novel? Do you have questions for Ron about his writing? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send us an email. That's talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Stay with us because at noon today, we're going to talk to the artistic director of the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. We'll get some updates about their new space in downtown Milwaukee, hear about their upcoming season. But first, we are talking to Ron Rindo, the author of Life and Death and Giants. So, Ron, we talked a little bit about Hannah. Why don't you read an excerpt from your book? And this is in... from her.
Sure. Right. So Hannah is, she's lives on a farm, clearly, and she's outdoors in her garden and with her animals on a regular basis. So this is a chapter it's about two-thirds of the way through, and she's about to have a walk with her sister, who's visiting for her father's funeral, and they're about to have a very difficult conversation. So she's just reminiscing about the fall, September in Wisconsin, and so since it is September, and the beauty of the September is a big part of this short passage. It also gives you a sense of Hannah's introspection. All my life, autumn has been my favorite time of year. By mid-September, jars of fruits and vegetables filled our pantry shelves to sagging. Hundreds of carrots and potatoes nestled in the sand of our root cellar. Hay to last the winter had been cut, baled, and stacked in the barn. The mornings were cold and still. I would rise long before Josiah and dress in the dark. As early light washed the night gray, I would pull on my boots and slip out the door. I'd tread the road away from my father's house, out of sight of my still sleeping goats, walking the half mile to a pasture we'd left fallow for years, bounded by the river and back an overgrown hedgerow on two sides, 5 acres gone to wild beauty. It is one of my favorite places. I would enter the field just as sunlight began to color the earth, my boots following deer trails through the tall grass. I'd smile at the impressions of their delicate feet in the earth, like a string of small broken hearts. At that time of year, goldenrod is in bloom. Lacy stands of staghorn sumac have gone red, the seed horns a beacon for cardinals and chickadees. Along the far hedgerow, a flock of cedar waxwings might weave through the hawthorns, gorging on the tiny red fruit. My dress would grow heavy and wet along the bottom where it was mottled with cockle burrs and brambles, and I would marvel at the Lord's genius in making me, like the wind and birds, a sower of the seeds of his bounty. Alone with my thoughts, I often reproach myself for shameful jealousies, bewildering moments of vanity, inexplicable impatience, retching anger with Josiah. It troubled me that age and experience had not ameliorated my imperfections. If anything, when I examined the arc of my life, I found that thoughts or actions I at one time would have avoided for fear of damnation, I now engaged with only minimal worry or none at all.
It's lovely, perfect for today, even though it's very warm outside. But yeah, oh, that's gorgeous. Thank you for sharing that with us. Your descriptions are so well done. How do you know when you've gone far enough, and how do you know when you've not gone far enough with descriptions?
Yeah, that's a tricky thing for all writers, you know. So you're either Balzac, I'll use French writers, who just would have gone page upon page upon page, right? Or the writer of Madame Bovary, who would have just given you, you know, one or two or three, what he called, right, le mot juste, the right, the right word. You know, you're making a movie in your reader's mind, right? So you want them to be able to see and hear and smell and, you know, the world that you created, but you also want to continue to move the narrative forward. So it's always a bit of a juggling act, you know. The pacing of this book is, it's not the pacing of a thriller or, you know, a mystery. It has a more leisurely pace that goes with its thematic focus, I think, and with the sort of the atmosphere of the place, right? Yeah. This rural Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's like timing in a song and music. It's got a steady beat that keeps going and just unfolds as it goes. So we talked about Hannah a little bit. Let's talk about Billy Walton. Okay, so we know he's a bar owner. I love the name of the bar, Shaken Not Stirred.
Shaken Not Stirred, yes.
Tell us about Billy. He's had an interesting background.
Yeah, he does. So Billy, because he grew up in a bar, right? He grew up in one of these places where the bar is downstairs and the apartment upstairs is where he lived with his parents. He was an only child. And starting around the age of 12, he started putting beer into his soda cup. And he would be down in the bar, and he gradually becomes an alcoholic. And that really troubles his life for up through his 20s into his 30s. Gets married twice. He has children by both of his wives. He gets divorced. He loses custody of his children and gradually loses touch with his children. So he loves sports. It's a sports bar. He coaches Little League, but he has a heart attack off the page. And so he has to quit drinking, and he does quit drinking. But he loves sports, and he falls in love with Gabriel. And when he starts to coach him as a little boy and really wants him to continue playing baseball, when his brother Jasper dies and Gabriel is taken in by his Amish grandparents, who he starts to wear Amish clothing, he starts to work on the farm and becomes schooled in an Amish school, Billy really is upset about it because he wants him to continue playing. And so when Gabriel suddenly shows up on the football team at age 17, Billy is overjoyed. And he, decorates his entire bar with the high school colors. And so he tells the story of Gabriel from the point of view of someone who's a sports fanatic and who really wants him to succeed as an athlete because it just gives him great joy. And that love for Gabriel really starts to change him too because he becomes a little bit softer, a little bit more open to relationships with other people and ultimately finds himself in a relationship with a woman that he loves, which he says, I didn't expect this to happen. I don't know how this happened.
I love the way they connect.
Yes.
That's really, really sweet. Yeah.
Yeah. He stopped to change the tire of a car. Estelle Smith says she's been widowed when her husband dies. And
which
he has
trouble.
I don't
mean to laugh, but the way the poor guy dies.
Yes. Well, he's at a New Year's Eve party and it's 20 below. It's a Wisconsin, and he's drunk, he's driving home, and his car breaks down, and he gets out of the car to walk home 3 miles, and it's 25 below, and of course he freezes to death.
Yes, and you say that way in the beginning, and then I'm like, who's this person again? Oh, that's right. Oh, poor lady. Yeah.
Right, she shows up, but yeah, at the end.
She shows up at the end.
Oh, okay,
yes,
that's what
she shows up at the end. Okay, so we've got Billy, and then let's talk about let's go to Trey first, who's the football coach. And he's got a really interesting background, too.
Yeah, so Lakota is made up of these people who have been there for a long time. But there are also some people who have come from other places. And Thomas has come up from Milwaukee, the veterinarian. And Billy has been there. Hannah has been there. But Trey comes up from Texas. And so he has come the farthest, but he has been a college football coach, a big-time football coach. He has been recruiting all over the country. He has been used to coaching these really first-rate five-star athletes. But at the same time, he is also an addict himself. And so when his life implodes, he loses his job, he loses his family. His aunt owns a horse farm up in Lakota. And when his family in Texas disowns him because of his behavior, she invites him to come up and live with her and her partner. And so he comes up from Texas and moves in and just works at a gas station and just tries to pull his life back together. And then one of his, I think it's his aunt or his aunt's partner, they see an ad for the football coach job after about a year, the local high school football coach, and he applies and gets the job. And so that's where he becomes enamored with Gabriel. He sees Gabriel out in the field with a couple of other Amish boys loading hay on a wagon, and he's throwing hay bales with one hand, 13 feet high, the top of, and he goes home and he gets on a scale with the bales of hay at this horse farm, and they weigh 45, 50 pounds. And he tries to throw one, and he can get it maybe 7-8 feet high. And he's, you know, a former linebacker, he's
sure.
A big guy. And he realizes that he has to try to talk this huge boy into coming and playing football for him. And he has to go and talk to his grandparents and convince them to let him play football.
Why was it important for this character to have that experience? It could have been just a local coach. Why did you have the experience?
Yeah, I wanted someone who was a really, really good coach. And someone, high school football in Texas is not high school football in Wisconsin.
No.
They're 20, 30,000 people show up to games there. The football coaches there are first rate. They know the game inside and out, and he's been a really good recruiter. But he also has to be humbled, right? He is humbled. He's coaching this tiny, this little middle of nowhere team after he just was coaching Division I, you know, college football. And so he's got this sort of ragtag group. He's got these linemen who are vomiting on the field when they get tired. And, you know, but he gradually puts together this team. The quarterback and one of the wide receivers are from Mexico. Their top running back has come over from Africa. And then there's Gabriel. And so they cobble together this amazing team. They go on ultimately to win the state championship.
Oh, you gave it away.
I did.
And the football scenes are really good. I mean, I like football. I'm a fan. But I think it's just enough where if someone who's reading it was maybe not, I think that they would get all of that without really getting into it.
Yeah, there have been some readers who say they kind of skip over some of the football
stuff.
They shouldn't. I had a lot more football in an earlier draft, and I cut a lot. But there is enough. I mean, football is one of my passions. You know, I always taught my students to put your passions in your work. It doesn't matter what they are. If you're passionate about it, readers will react to that. And so I've got Emily Dickinson here. I've got football. I've got trout fishing. I've got art, art museums. I've got reading literature. All of those things, I really, you know, I just kept putting them all in there.
Yeah. And you've got animals.
Oh, animals. Yes.
They play a very large role in this.
They do. Mm-hmm. They do. They play a really, really large role. So Gabriel, as a young boy, is modeled after my youngest son, who loved animals as well. We have pictures of Noah sitting on the porch.
And his name is Noah?
His name is Noah.
How appropriate is that?
Yes. And he was sitting on the porch as a little boy with maple syrup, one of our bantam roosters who would just sit on Noah's lap and Noah would feed him white bread. And then he would pet him and maple syrup would fall asleep on his lap.
Oh.
So, yeah, I mean, this is a book about, ultimately, it's a book about redemption, but also about community, right? And about how these people come from all these different places, and they're all very different backgrounds and very different religious beliefs and so forth. And animals are also part of that community for me. Animals and trees, you know, to know the names of things and to live with other living things the way in which these people do. Thomas is a veterinarian, right? Mm. He was devoted his life to caring for animals. My wife and I, for many years, we raised Shetland sheep, and we still have chickens. And one time, one of our sheep was down overnight. She was giving birth, and she could not do it. She had two really large ram lambs. And so in the morning, we went out there expecting to find her with two lambs, and she was still down. And so we had to call a veterinarian. And I tell you, those large animal veterinarians, it's very dangerous work. It's not nearly as remunerative as being a companion animal. And they just love animals so much, and they just do such incredible work. So I love that I could honor that, you know, that kind of work. When I was a boy, I kind of wanted to be a veterinarian, but I couldn't have handled the math and the science for sure. And so I get to be a veterinarian in a way and in this book.
It's kind of nice like that. Like we're going to be talking about theater in a little bit. Yes. And it's like the same thing. You get to pretend to be the things that you've always wanted to be.
Exactly. So, yes, yeah, for sure.
Very cool. All right. So our last character, and this is the one where we don't get the first person narrative. That's Thomas Kennedy, a veterinarian, mm-hmm. obviously. Tell us about him. He's got a lot of depth on this character.
Yeah, so Thomas is someone who's had a rough, his wife passed away under circumstances that some people, you know, believe that he was partly responsible for that. And so he, in a sense, and he's a very sensitive person, and he wasn't responsible, and yet he did cause her death. And so when he flees and ends up in Lakota, he just was trout fishing on this river and sees a house and decides this is a place where I should move. But he is someone who's haunted by this thing that happened to him. And he prefers the company of animals to the company of human beings. And because he's a veterinarian, he meets all of these people, not just the sort of what the Amish call the English, right, the farmers, but also the Amish themselves. And so he is one of these characters who is exposed to everyone, right? And all that. What I tried to do with this story is braid together these relationships to show how community forms. And so Thomas is someone who is connected to pretty much everyone because of the nature of his work. And he's also agnostic, which is interesting, because his interactions with Hannah, which get more and more in depth as the novel goes on, introduces that tension, right? So even though he's agnostic, he is also extraordinarily kind. And she tells him at one point, she said, "You have done more for the people, for animals and for everyone than any 100 other people have been," even though he's not strictly a believer in her sense, and someone probably she shouldn't even be interacting with according to her faith. So he has to go it's wrong to say it's against his faith, but he has to work with people who are devoutly, devoutly religious, and does so and finds them marvelous to work with, and vice versa, right? And so the kinds of things that unfortunately divide so many Americans today aren't things that divide the people in this community. They find their ways through and around those things. And it's all about the way in which they care for one another and they care for other living things in their community.
That's one thing that really caught my eye, too, is that he tells, Hannah and her husband how he feels, you know, what his beliefs are, and he accepts theirs for what they are. They accept his, and neither mm-hmm. one tries to change the other.
Right.
But they do come together because they all love this boy.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Gabriel, the metaphor I've used in other conversations, he's like the sun. And all of these other characters are the planets that are circling him. Like he's, in a sense, his gravitational force, and I guess that's not the sun, the way the sun works, but he draws them all to him and thus also to one another. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, it's their love for him which makes them see through all of the differences and see beyond the differences, because they all have this very common denominator. And the way in which he has lived his life, right, also has... You know, Hannah goes one direction, right? And Thomas kind of goes the other. I mean, Hannah goes from only reading religious books to moving out beyond that. She starts with Dickinson, but then she has this whole library ultimately available to her. She reads Zora Neale Hurston, and she reads Aeneas Nin, and those are things that she realized. And then she goes to the Art Institute in Chicago.
Oh, that was great.
And so, you know, there are things in the English world that she finds so entrancing, and she can't go back. She uses that metaphor, you know, you can't put the pumpkin back into the seed.
That was great.
And yet she has to try,
Yeah. Now, how did you learn about the Amish community and what happens behind closed doors?
So, first of all, Hannah, her character, she's based on a Puritan poet by the name of Anne Bradstreet, who struggled with her own faith at times. And she wrote these beautiful poems where she is trying to be this perfect Puritan woman. Now, the Puritans come out of, they both come out of the 17th century Reformation, the Puritans and the Amish, but slightly different. There's a beautiful poem that Anne Bradstreet writes called Here Follow Some Lines Upon the Burning of Our House, 1650, where her house burns down and she loses all her books and all of her furniture and all these beautiful things. And you cannot replace those things, right, in 17th century New England. And she is so sad about it. And she wanders through the ashes and just bemoans the loss of all of these things and comes at the very end of the poem. She says, "The world no longer let me love. My hope and treasure lies above." And no one believes that she really believes that at that point, right? She loves all of these things, you know? And so with Hannah, she comes out of the Anabaptist tradition, but it's the same where your earthly life is really supposed to be just transitory and you're supposed to be living for this other world, right? This other life. And that's how Amish live their lives, right? The earthly life is really of almost no consequence. That your desire is eternity. And so everything you do on earth is focused on the afterlife, right? And so your life is almost irrelevant in some ways. But like Anne Bradstreet, that's not how things work for her. She loves her animals. She loves nature. She loves Gabriel. She loves her daughter, right, with such great passion. And she's trying to figure out how she can honor her faith while also pursuing these more secular loves. She goes to the museum, right? She loves books. And so she's torn in this really complicated way, trying to honor her faith, but also, you know, follow the dictates of her heart. And so she, for me, is my favorite character by far. She's so introspective and so thoughtful and so humble. And she arrives at conclusions only after much thought. But also acknowledges her own fallibility all the way through. I mean, she's such a wonderful person. I just find her, you know, someone to aspire to, really, because she brings out just so much goodness in others and around her, and is constantly in a struggle for that goodness herself.
Mm-hmm. I think the scene where she, well, many times, but the first time she goes out in the middle of the night and she just watches, her daughter happens to be across the river and she can see what's going on and just stands there and for hours.
Yeah.
And she does that night after night.
Yeah, that's her first test really is, you know, Rachel refuses to name the father and so she is sent away from the community and shunning an Amish life is not, doesn't happen that often, but this is strang by dung. This is strong shunning because she has violated pretty substantial Amish rules. And so her parents have to let her live elsewhere, and they're not allowed to interact with her. And she is the mother, right? She wants to be present when she gives birth to Jasper, but she cannot be. And another woman takes her in. She lives across the river. She can see the house from her house. And she would get up in the middle of the night and go look out the kitchen window. She'd make up reasons. Oh, I have to get a drink or something. And finally, she can take it no more. And she literally, in the snow, she tromps out there with a chair and sits down to get closer. And her daughter is walking her baby back and forth these open windows. She can see these. Well, not they're not open, but they're lit. And she can see that. And she just wants to be with her daughter, but she wants to honor her faith. And, I mean, that is just a huge conflict, right? A huge interpersonal or personal conflict.
Definitely. We are talking with Ron Rindo. He's the author of the new book, Life and Death and Giants. If you have any comments or questions, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can also send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najel. Today we're talking about the novel Life and Death and Giants. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about wildlife with Scott Craven. And then we're going to hear about how antibiotic pollution might be harming amphibians. That's tomorrow starting at 11. Larry will be back to take you through that. But right now we're talking with Ron about his really good new book. Again, if you've got any questions or if you've read some of Ron's other work, please give us a call, 800-642-1234. We always like to talk with you. So, Ron, let's talk about location. So it's Wisconsin and very, very rural. What is it about that location that you wanted to share with your readers?
Well, it, you know, even though it's Lakota, I mean, it's based on Dakota, Wisconsin. And so most of the towns that are named in the book around Lakota are actual towns.
Right.
In fact, when we drive through Oxford on our way west across the state on Highway 82, I always point my wife to the BP station. I mean, that's where Trey worked when he came up from Texas.
That's
what I had in mind.
Uh-huh.
You know, what I tell students always, you know, is where you are is who you are. And for me, Wisconsin, specifically rural Wisconsin, where I live in rural Wisconsin, it's so much a part of who I have become. And I was born and raised in Wisconsin as well. And that involves everything, right? It involves the type of trees we have, the type of wildflowers and the grasses, the type of animals we see on a regular basis, our weather, right? The summers, the migrating geese and the migrating cranes. All those things are in this book, because I consider them part of our community, as I've said, and so for me, you know, place is so important to who these people are, and to how the novel moves forward, right? That they're all in the same shared space, and they all are surrounded by the same things, and their interactions with one another, and their interactions with the nature and wildlife and their gardens, all of that to me is part of what it means to live here.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to make sure that was, you know, sort of totally imbued in the atmosphere of the novel.
It is. You definitely are there when you're reading it.
Thank you.
We've got a question or a comment actually from Pam in Altoona. Go ahead, Pam.
Hi, I'm so excited to have come across you on the radio when I just turned it on. I absolutely adored your new book. It's one of my favorites that I read. I got an early copy of it, and I thought it was absolutely phenomenal. And one of the things, well, there are a lot of things I loved about it, but it features so many key aspects of Wisconsin that I think anyone who's ever lived or gone through Wisconsin is going to relate to either one of the settings or the sports aspect or the Badger football that comes in. And the Amish, it just has so many different things. One of the things I'm curious about is that the ending of the book has some magical realism components with the way nature and animals kind of react at the very end. And I'm wondering, what made you decide to put that in?
Well, first of all, Pam, thank you so much for reading and for seeing all that Wisconsin in there. Yes, you're absolutely right. The Badgers are here. All right. Gabriel plays for the Badgers, and we actually beat Ohio State in this book. So I don't know if that's going to happen anytime soon, but it happens here. So the scene you're talking about, it's interesting to me. A lot of people have read that scene and you know, said the same thing about it. Personally, I don't think about it as magical. And I've said this in other contexts too. I think of it as mysterious, and it's a slightly different way to view it because, you know, Thomas and Hannah have different reactions, right? Hannah believes in miracles, and she absolutely thinks it is one. Whereas Thomas says, you know, scientists, when they don't understand something, and there's a lot of stuff in nature scientists do not understand. And so for me, it is a very mysterious, yes, it's kind of magical. I don't disagree with that. But I'm not working in sort of the vein of Gabriel Garcia Marquez at all. It's just that moment. I mean, I guess there are two things. One, as an 18-pound baby is stretching the bounds of reality somewhat. And then that scene, yes, the interactions of the animals and the birds and the insects in particular really are unusual. But I am sort of Thomas on that point. He's sort of doubting Thomas, right? Whereas Hannah clearly is unmistakably saying that was a miracle. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I love that you brought that up.
Thank you, Pam. We really appreciate that. And also thank you for not revealing too much about the ending. We don't want to spoil it for anybody. But I think it was one of those things where the probability is very rare for that to happen, but mm-hmm. it could happen, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, 0.0001% chance, probably. But yeah, and when I was writing that, when I sat down to write that scene, I didn't intend for that to happen. It just happened. You know, I just started, and it just got to be more and more and more. You know, and it harkens back to Gabriel's birth scene, mm-hmm. Where he's born, and in response to his crying, you know, squirrels start chattering, coyotes start to howl.
Yeah.
You know, farm animals farther away start to bellow. And so his connection to those animals and to that life starts at birth, and it's still there.
What is it that these animals see or feel in Gabriel?
I think it's his size, ultimately, when he gets to be larger. But it's also his care for them. You know, cats and dogs, to go to domestic pets, they can tell when people are good people.
True.
They go to mm-hmm. some people and they stay away from others. And I don't know if it's how we move or, you know, how we interact with the world. But, you know, I think for Gabriel, in his sense, people and the animals are drawn to him. And so it makes sense that, you know, even, you know, as his life goes forward and you know, rough things start to happen to him, mm-hmm. that is the one constant that remains.
Mm-hmm, for sure. So how did you learn how to write?
I wanted to be a writer ever since I learned how to read.
Really?
I did. And, you know, when I started reading books, I kept a little notebook under the mattress of my bed, and I wrote short stories when I was a kid.
I love it.
And the only story I remember is called The Blind Colt. It was about a little boy who has a horse, and a cougar scratches the horse's eyes. I had never seen a cougar. I'd never been on a horse, you know, and I think I wouldn't have said it this way. But for me, I think I recognized early on that I wasn't going to be satisfied with the finiteness of a single life. And reading takes you outside of yourself, right? It moves you to places and people that you otherwise would never encounter in your single finite life. And so the same pleasures that I get from reading, I get from writing as well. And so, you know, I wanted to be a writer. And then what really cemented it is I went to a small Catholic school, third and fourth grade. We were in the same third grade and fourth grade in the same classroom. And we had this teacher named Mrs. Pritchett. And we'd go out for recess after lunch. And we'd come in, we'd be all sweaty. And of course, you know, still kind of antsy. And she would read to us out loud every single day for about 20 minutes after lunch. And she read Charlotte's Web and Little House on the Prairie and Little House in the Big Woods, which are both Wisconsin books,
yes,
by the way. And I was just, that was my favorite part of the day. And I just, from that moment on, I was like, I'm going to be a writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I the teachers that read or that assigned us books, unlike most students, I guess, I was thrilled and enthralled. Yes. And thank you. And, you know, I've read since I was little, too. My parents, yes. My mom read to me all the time. It's so important. But like you said, you can travel. You can create the world that
right.
you're traveling in.
And you can
in.
Be so many different people, right? Yeah. You transcend your own identity, your own gender, your own race. You can do those things. Mm-hmm. I can be a veterinarian. I can be a football coach. I can be an Amish grandmother, right?
Absolutely. So it's been kind of a whirlwind. We had chatted earlier where you've been doing a lot of appearances and book readings, etc.
I have. It's been really fun.
Yeah.
I've really enjoyed it. I also have been talking to some folks who have podcasts. I'm doing another one of those soon. Book clubs, online book clubs. I have one coming up on October 7th with a bookstore in Ohio.
That's great.
So it's been really enjoyable to talk with people about the book and to hear from folks.
And I was looking through Real Simple Magazine not too long ago, and they always have a page with the books they recommend. And I always kind of look at the end papers because I can, it's like, do we have those at our... And I saw yours.
I know. It's been, I tell you, the publicity folks, everyone I've worked with at St. Martin's Press, they've been just so amazing. Yeah, we were in a Real Simple magazine, and then this week we're in People magazine.
You are? Yes. Oh, I didn't see that. But you were in Milwaukee magazine, too.
Milwaukee magazine, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And then, you know, Kirkus and Publishers Weekly and all those places. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of been a little embarrassing to see this all over
Well, you are a Midwestern boy, right?
I know, it's true.
Difficult.
It's true.
But that's it's great and it's kind of scary at the same time, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it is.
So what happens next now? Are you writing something?
I am. Mm-hmm. I am. I'm working on another novel. And so I just, not very far into it, probably mm-hmm. about 50 pages. And it's also a polyphonic novel. It has, but in this case, just three different narrators.
Okay.
And it's set in contemporary America, like, Right now.
So much to work with.
Yes, there's a lot to work with, actually. Yeah, the main character is a Catholic priest who's not a very good Catholic and not a very good priest, but an amazing person, and his twin sister.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
And their desire to smuggle some refugees into the country through Canada.
Okay. Yeah, well, that sounds very good. So you make sure that we get on that list for those advanced reading copies.
Of course.
Talk a little bit about your process now. Do you have a bunch of things that you've jotted down over the years, or do you kind of focus in on one thing and kind of stick with that till it's done?
Yeah, for most of my life, I've worked on multiple things at the same time, which is very common for short story writers in particular. And for most of my career, I was a short story writer. Mm-hmm. My wife and I were raising five kids. I had a job in the academy where you have to publish on a fairly regular basis. And, you know, just doing novels was not something that I just could work out, you know. But now the kids are out of the house and I have a lot more time so I can focus just on a single thing. I like to write in the mornings when I'm more awake and alert. And sometimes that'll stretch later into the early afternoon, or sometimes not. I just focus on one narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the tricks that I've discovered, I mean, my first book is just a really long short story, ultimately. Breathing Lake Superior is like a short story that got
fairly short,
out of hand, and it's just one narrator. But with Life and Death and Giants and with the new novel, you know, I get the pleasures of writing short stories where you create characters who have distinct voices, and then I weave those separate stories together. The new novel, I think the stories are going to be more separate, sort of like a Robert Stone novel, A Flag for Sunrise, title also came from Emily Dickinson, where he has like three separate narratives going, and then at some point, maybe halfway or two-thirds, they come together. I think that's what I'm going to try to do here. He always said he learned to write novels from Joseph Conrad, so maybe Conrad's novels do that as well. But I'm going to focus on one thing and see where it goes.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a board up with all of your ideas and
information? I don't, but I usually have to keep track in a notebook, like with Life and Death and Giants. There's so many characters, and trying to keep the narrative and the chronology straight and so forth. That part is a little more complicated.
Because if you don't, your readers are going to tell you, right?
They will. They'll say, wait a minute, this doesn't work.
Wait a second. Yes. So would you consider yourself an observer of life?
I think so.
Okay.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, there's always this tension in writers' lives between the desire to be out and about in the world and then the requirement to be sitting still in one place outside of, you know, that. I think I pay attention, and I think, you know, I learned to do that when I was a boy. Mm-hmm. Even though I love to be around people and I love community and I love conversation, there's a strong part of me that still likes to just be alone or to just be on the watch, as it were, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're just watching and paying attention and trying to learn things.
Yeah.
I mean, I think as I get older, it's interesting. As you get older, even though you know more, you get more humble. And you just become so much more aware of the complexities and the gray areas of life. And those are the things I think that make for really good fiction.
They do, for sure. And you are just, you can just tell by your personality, you're calm, you're still, but you definitely are an observer. So mm-hmm. do you think that that's something that someone is out there who really maybe wants to write, needs to kind of step back a little bit and do?
I totally think that's right. I mean, I always quote Annie Dillard, right? Annie Dillard says, in the physical world, the greatest absorbers are also the greatest emitters, right? So blacktop absorbs heat, and it puts out the heat. And I think for people, I think that metaphor works.
I love it. Well, Ron, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I really appreciate you writing this book and for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much, Jill. I love being here with you.
Wonderful. Ron Rindo is the author of Life and Death and Giants. And if you do anything today, it's find this book. Get it at your library. Check it out. But you need to read it. Thank you. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and we are going to be talking about the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. And we have artistic director Mark Clements with us, and we're going to talk about the new season, the new performing spaces, and basically what it's like behind the curtain at the Milwaukee Rep. Let us know why you love theater. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Mark, thanks for being with us again.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You bet. One of my favorite topics, of course, is theater. So I'm really excited about the new space. It's called the Associated Bank Theater Center. And tell us a little bit about it. Now, you've kind of redone a lot of the spaces you had, right?
Yeah. So we made a conscious decision to stay downtown in our beautiful site. It's a classic building, and we felt it would have left a real sort of cultural cavity in the city if we did, you know, with the advent of FISA Forum and the Pabst Theater, the New Milwaukee Ballet and the Symphony Orchestra felt really wise to stay down. Of course, the building was a former power station, the Oneida Power Station, and then in 1986-87, it got renovated to a theater that we know now, the Milwaukee Rep. And it was, at the time, it was a state-of-the-art building with three performance spaces within it, adjacent to the Pabst Theater, where we have a 50-year tradition of doing Christmas Carol. And when the architects came, they looked at it and they were like, wow, you don't want to get rid of these beautiful foundations because you can't even build these in this day and age. And so there were a lot of reasons why we decided to stay downtown, but there were some things that we really wanted to change. For me, there are many, but I mean, I do think it's much more user-friendly. Audiences in regional theater tend to skew a little bit older. And so a lot of people stop coming to the theater, not because they have a desire, but mobility issues, ease of access, all of those things become a little bit more challenging as people get older. And I think, you know, I truly feel that this building offers potential for some of those people that might fit into that category to be extend their theater going by 15 or 20 years. And the other cool thing is that the seats are much more comfortable, the sight lines are better, so, you know, there's not really a bad seat in the theater. And also, we can do multiple types of staging, proscenium arch staging and thrust staging, if that means something to some people. But it means you can either have the rep like it was how we used to, or you can actually turn it into a conventional proscenium, like a frame, which will be very good for us moving shows to New York or further afield.
Right. And we're talking options. Options are important when you're trying to produce a show, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think this will excite writers and directors to know that, you know, they're not just locked into one space on the main stage. I mean, I think we've done in the last couple of decades have done a pretty good job at circumnavigating the, you know, the constraints that we had with us. But I think, you know, this is going to be really offer some very exciting options and have a very different experience each time you come in, you know, which is what you hope to see on the stage. And now you'll actually feel it from your seats, too.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Now, is everything ready? You're going to be opening soon, aren't you?
Yeah, everybody asks that question. You know, and the truth is, on time, on budget, thanks to a lot of brilliant people who actually brought their A game to it. But, you know, I almost don't want to say those words. It's like when people go, hey, how's your show going? You know,
right.
And the last thing I want to say is brilliant, you know, because, you know, fate has a strange way of coming back to bite you.
Yes, well, theater folks are a bit superstitious, so I understand. Okay, so officially we're supposed to be opening. You've got Bernadette Peters coming, which is quite a coup. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we wanted to do a couple of different openings. You know, this is an extraordinary building, and it has three different spaces. The Stackner Cabaret space is just having a facelift and a tweak and with its dressing rooms and things, but that's probably how people remember it for the last 2 or 3 years, because we did a fairly extensive refurb of that in 17. But the main stage, and which is the Ellen and Joe Chakota Powerhouse Theater, and the studio, which is the Hero Frankie studio, they will both have brand new openings coming up. Now, the first opening was like, hey, we want to have something, a one-nighter, a real special ribbon-cutting event. And so, you know, we looked at who would be our top choices if we could get anybody. And we thought, in terms of living legends in the American theater, it doesn't really get better than Bernadette Peters.
No.
And so we asked her if she would come and perform and be the very first person to grace that, the first performer to grace those boards, so to speak. And she agreed to do that. So on October the 11th, we're doing that, ribbon cutting and a full day of celebration. And then we start moving into, there'll be a little 2 or 3 weeks while we load Income From Away, which would be our inaugural production in there, and it's doing really, really well already. I think people will love that show, and I think they're excited to see the new space and be part of history. So that will be in November.
Yeah, I've got my ticket, so I'm looking forward to that. Been wanting to see that show for a long time, and people a little bit about what the background is on that, just real quick.
Yeah, it was based on a book. I think the title was something like When the World Came to Town, which is really what happened on 9/11, when a lot of planes that were in transit after the catastrophe and tragedy of the Twin Towers and obviously the other flights in Pennsylvania, they were required, US airspace was required to clear all flights, get every flight on the ground, because at that time we didn't know obviously if there were more threats out there, if we were going to be having more of those incidents that we, many of us, tragically saw unfolding on TV, on live TV. And so a lot of these planes needed to be grounded mid-Atlantic, and Gander is in Newfoundland, is a midway point, and actually had a sufficiently large airfield to take a lot of planes, because in the past it had been used before planes could do a whole transatlantic flight unfueled. They offered, the Gander offered an opportunity to refuel planes mid-Atlantic, so to speak. And so a lot of flights were naturally diverted there. And 7,000 passengers on that day landed in this little town in Newfoundland, which was just going about its business on that day, and ended up being a refuge for over a week for people who were grounded. Everything from first-class passengers to coach, animals on board, and really the town had to rally around and make sure that people had basic needs, sanitary needs, food needs. And this was a town that was sort of stretched to the limit, and the people's generosity knew no bounds. And so the writers of Come From Away read this book and this account, and of course we were familiar, those of us that were around at the time, with a lot of these extraordinary stories, and turned this into a musical called Come From Away. And it's just had been a global hit. And I, you know, right now I think there's a lot of productions. I mean, we decided to do it once they stopped touring it. And then we heard there's like 23 productions around the nation.
Wow.
And that's just in the U.S. And I think it was just because it's such an uplifting musical. Mm-hmm. And it's about a time when the nation was in fear and offered a... came together as a community in the best way that human beings could. And it was very emblematic of that. And I think that story, in a strange way, I mean, you, whatever you say and wherever you land in the political spectrum these days, you know, there is no question we are broken at the moment and we're a very polarized country. And so I think this is theater at its best, offering up a way for people to literally sit next to each other in the theater and watch a time when people actually were at their most amazing. Yes. Is that even a word? Amazingness?
Sure. It is now. Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. That really is a pull, I think, that most people are looking for, that time when we all came together. So that's going to be a wonderful show. Again, that's Come From Away, and that's going to be the Rep's first show. When did you say it opened? November, right?
Yeah, I wish I had our press officer here right away. But I mean, while we're checking, well, I can look.
Yeah, no, that's fine. That's fine.
It's early November, and there's kind of a preview period. We have one performance, which is a private performance before we open, which we're going to invite all of the construction workers and people who are part of building this extraordinary.
What a great idea. I love that. I love that.
Yeah, well, it'd be a great thank you, a very exclusive thank you to them. And then also it will give us a chance to roll it out to the paying public and make sure, you know, it's very strange because we're working in a brand new building. So, you know, when I was putting musicals or plays on, I've directed, I don't know, over 25 shows, I guess, at the Rep over the years since 2010, musicals, plays, all sorts of theater. But I know every inch of those stages. I know how it sounded when you were in them, which seat you couldn't see a full human being and all that stuff. And now I'm going to be discovering all of that for the first time with the amazing cast I've got again. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. And Clara told me, our producer, that it's November 4th.
Seems familiar.
Yep. And tickets are available, of course. You just have to go to the Milwaukee Rep. Is it org or com? It's dot com. So yeah. Wonderful. Excellent. We are talking with Mark Clements. He's the artistic director at the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. If you have any questions about some of the upcoming shows or what the new facility is going to look like, we'd love to hear from you. 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najo in for Larry today. I want to remind you our next book club novel is coming up. It's called Beyond the Flames, and it's by Wisconsinite Greg Renz. Greg is a retired firefighter, and he uses his experience in the field to write stories about others who have this important job. And we're going to talk to Greg on October 16th, so time still for you to go and get that book. Again, it's Beyond the Flames, and you can join us on our book club. Right now, we are talking about the Milwaukee Rep with Artistic Director Mark Clements. So, Mark, let's, fun and games, wonderful, you get to put on a show and whatnot, but let's talk about funding for a moment. You know, we can kind of relate here at public media a little bit about this, but earlier this month, the Milwaukee County Committee on Parks Parks and Culture rejected a proposed budget plan for funding arts groups, and they had proposed 25% cut on the money that would be split between many of the arts groups, including the REP. And now it's gone back to the drawing board for the committee. How important is that funding to the Milwaukee REP?
Well, I don't want to be disingenuous about it, because every cent is important for a not-for-profit, as you understand.
Sure.
But I mean, I will say that we as an organization, while we're constantly trying to pivot to, different income streams, and losing anything is obviously not a good place for us to be. But, we are in a way, we're very fortunate that we are not overly reliant on county, city, NEA funding. You know, when it comes in, it allows us to do more. So it is critical. It's really if you think about funding, most of we're a bit of an outlier. And, there are being articles written on us in recent times. Recently, we were a cover story in the art section of the Chicago Trib. We're going to be a lead story in the New York Times in the not too distant future about how the REP is a bit of an outlier. But one of the things that I think is extraordinary about the REP is that, and including the funding of this $80 million construction, all but $2 million that came from the state of Wisconsin, 1.9 specifically, were funded individually from people who gave, very large eight-figure gifts to people who gave three-figure gifts. And it really is a people's theater in that respect. That money was raised, if you think about it, pretty extraordinary post-pandemic in 2 years, almost from start to finish of that campaign. And we are very reliant on our audiences and our extremely dedicated trustees and stakeholders to make sure that we can do the work at the level we're doing it. But, it's hard work for, it's a competitive market for arts funding, with both public and private philanthropy. And, the REP is very organized and focused on what we need to do. And we think we provide a consistently strong program and progressive program of work, in terms of the styles of things that we do, and everything from sort of two-hander plays that are mission vision orientated to big gold standard musicals. We do that and everything in between. So, I think people love that, and we're very fortunate that we work hard to maintain that, and people support us. But when you think of what the REP does, we have a $40 million footprint in the community and state, which is a lot of money. If you think about it, when you go to the theater, you're probably using one of the local restaurants or a parking facility, and so a hotel. So all of that, is what makes a community really rich and vibrant. And, the arts in Milwaukee, in the city, is extraordinary. What we have, when you think we're a city that is really 600,000 people.
And how many theaters? It seems like every year there's a new one out there. Oh, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm with you. I missed your question.
Oh, okay. I just said, how many theaters are there in Milwaukee right now? I mean, there's so many. It seems like there's always a new one popping up.
Yeah, I mean, we are the largest producing theater in the state. There's a very good theater, Forward Theater in Madison. There's a number of smaller theaters, Renaissance and Next Act and Skylight in the in Milwaukee. And then we have the ballet, and we have the symphonic orchestra, and we have an incredible music scene, with Fiserv, obviously Summerfest, and the Pabst Theater Group that operate out of numerous theaters. But it's a lot of arts. There's a lot, you can probably do something every single night of the year and still have options in a city of our size, which is pretty extraordinary in live performance.
It is amazing. And as you mentioned before, you do bring in a lot of money into the city. You know, we tend to think about sports teams doing that, but people really underestimate what the arts does bring to a city, don't they?
Well, yeah, if you think about it, you know, we do 700 performances a year. So, you know, that's a lot of performances. When I read the show reports on a weekend at the Rep, you know, you've got maybe five shows on a Friday through Monday. That, you know, in three different performance spaces. So if you do the math, you know, that's a lot of show reports. That's a lot of shows just out of Milwaukee Rep.
Yes, yes. Go right ahead.
No, I was going to say it's like 15 shows just out of the Rep in a weekend when all three spaces are up and running.
Right.
And then, you know, you've got 1,000 people a night coming to see Christmas Carol. So it is huge. Mm-hmm. And you know, we feel it, you know, when we've been shut. People, you know, if I go into a local business, people will say, when are you guys back? We're really missing you. We need your people again. So I think this is a cautionary tale for, you know, our city leaders and our visionaries who plan, and both in our city and further afield, that, you know, you have to look at what makes a city rich. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, there are some big employers here in Milwaukee. You know, whether it's Northwestern Mutual, Harley Davidson, BMO Harris, Associated Bank, big corporations. And, you know, they're hiring a lot of people. And one of the things when they're hiring their top tier people, and not just top tier, is what is going to be great about the moving myself and my family to a place. Yes, it's a prerequisite to have good schools and good medical facilities available. But what about the park? What about the arts provision? What about the waterfront? What about all of the things, the events that make a city rich in its tapestry and make you want to live here? Because if you are recruiting in Milwaukee, which is in ice for 6 months of the year, as opposed to San Diego in California, you've got to have a pretty good argument, you know, you and your family should come here. And I think there are many good arguments. I mean, as somebody who travels a third of the year, I will say the restaurant and bar scene is phenomenal. I mean, just when I bring people from out of town to some of these top restaurants in the city, people are just blown away. They cannot believe that. We experience it time and time again. And, you know, all of these things feed each other. And so I think it's really important when, you know, city planners think about these things, about when you take something away, you know, it's like the Jenga puzzle. When you pull a piece out of the puzzle, are you weakening the infrastructure? And the answer is an emphatic yes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, and thank you for that. Very eloquent. Let's go on now to something that happened to y'all in August. And a lot of people, unfortunately, was flooding. And it wasn't your performance space, but it was your the place where you keep your props and your sets and your costumes. So tell us what happened there.
Well, yeah, and in truth, it was a little bit more than that as well. We call it our production facility. It's in Wauwatosa. And when we had the floods, it was like it never happened before in years and years and years. Like, they're calling it the 1,000-year flood. I don't know. I think it was I don't know if there's an exact science behind it. You know, and people have got a lot of theories about forest fires amalgamating with a heat wave, but there were a confluence of happenings that basically created like 12 inches of rainfall, which is, doesn't sound much, but is a phenomenal amount in a very short time.
Yes.
To give you some context, you know, we are in a warehouse that has steel roller doors. So the sort of doors that you kind of might see at the back of a shopping mall, you know, or a supermarket. Heavy, you know, if I gave you a sledgehammer, you probably wouldn't be able to hammer through it. And yet the pressure of the water, 3.5 feet of water in the space in a short amount of time was enough to literally blow through those doors like it was a tin can, and have, you know, pieces of detritus, and it was raw sewage going through there as well. So it was devastating. So in addition to, yes, it is a place of storage. I mean, it wiped out 70 years of theater making. It was pretty awful. It wiped out a ton of audiovisual equipment that we were storing there only because we were actually building our new building. Mm-hmm. It's our beautiful set by Todd Ivins of Christmas Carol, for my adaptation of A Christmas Carol, that we've been doing at the Pab since 2016. And of course, this year, it's a really important year. I mean, it's always important, but this year it's our 50th anniversary. And then in addition to that, it's now the place where we make our scenery. We fabricate it. So we were actually in the middle of just about to start prep work. And we just finished this beautiful center, billions of dollars worth of equipment. So it, basically, the flood took out $7.5 million worth of damage that was insurance assessed. And so, you know, it's not just whether you can get the money back. It's just that some of those things are just irreplaceable for myriad reasons. And the reason why we're making scenery out there is because we actually now have the Hertzfeld Foundation Education Center where the old workshops were on site, which means now for the 25, 30,000 students that we serve in public schools every year, they can now come in and have fantastic facilities, not have to eat their lunch on the floor, not, you know, skew around a TV set to see a presentation, but actually can have state-of-the-art audiovisual possibilities and rehearsal opportunities. So it was a great thing, but then obviously we had this flood that just changed everything, and that was in the middle of August. And at a critical time, when we'd stored Christmas Carol, we were about to build Come From Away and our opening It's a Wonderful Life show. So those were out there, and the Lehman Trilogy, which was the set that was in storage. So all of that's had to be rebuilt. And as we speak right now, Come From Away is in San Francisco being constructed. Christmas Carol's being fabricated in Calgary, in Canada. So yeah, we're on track. We, you know, the team were unbelievable. The staff were just incredible. I never heard anyone moan. They were in impossibly awful conditions, hot, you know, wading through raw sewage, and you know, it was a phenomenal job in clearing up, and amazing how quickly they did it and the level of devastation that it left behind.
Well, that is really amazing and certainly a huge team effort to get all this taken care of. And so I'm assuming those sets are going to get put on some trucks and shipped back to Milwaukee. Is that how you're doing it?
That's exactly it. Yeah, I don't know exactly the timetable. I think Christmas Carol might take a little bit longer. And then, of course, the other thing we have to... Christmas Carol is a very complicated set. You know, it's a double turntable, a lot of automation. So it has to be constructed in a place where we can see that it's actually working. You know, if it's like, you know, it's equivalent to Disney touring Lion King or something like that. You know, it's a lot of moving parts, and you have to make sure that that's all working. And you have a very short amount of time to load into the Pabst Theater. I think they were very generous and helped us find an extra couple of days, given the circumstances. But it's still going to be really tight. But, you know, we are absolutely dedicated to the show must go on. And all of those shows will open on time. And we were very fortunate in the flood that the building was not harmed. And in fact, John Hunzinger is Hunzinger Construction, and John Hunzinger is the CEO of that company, was down here very early, that night and early the next morning, just making down in the basement, moving around, just seeing, you know, how things were and whether we needed to get bilge pumps in. Fortunately, we survived that particular test, which is a good sign in many ways, actually.
Yes. So when would you think you'll be able to start working again in that space?
It's already started.
Oh, great.
Well, yeah, I think it will. When I say it started, the space was cleaned out. What's going in there now is what was, the basic tools. I mean, you're talking about some very sophisticated lathes and cutting materials. And so all of those have had to be replaced, repurchased, moved into where they were before, powered up. So our team, while they are building our sets elsewhere, instead of doing that, they're making sure that we'll be able to do the next tranche of shows, which will happen in the next month or two. They're making sure that we are able to construct again in those spaces.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck with all that. I hope everything goes along swimmingly. I hate to use that word, but I can't even imagine what it's like with all this stuff going on. How do you keep all those balls in the air, Mark?
Well, it's a fantastic team. I think, we've got good people in all areas of the operation, experienced people. And, they're very, they've adapted so well. Melissa Bartanian, who is our managing director, she's been overseeing the building with Stephen Chamberlain, who's our kind of on-site, project manager for one. He's far more important than that, but that's the term that describes what he does. And they have really, Melissa's a theater person. She started off as a technical director, went as a production manager, and then into management and general management. And, she's literally overseeing everything from the wallpaper that goes up to the seats. Are they kind of, what we said they were, the fabric finishes? And so people have had to learn a whole load of skills. I mean, for example, I was brought into EUA, which are our architects in Milwaukee-based firm, and to look at the lighting for each area. And I had no idea, I think, at that point. Scenic lighting, obviously, I'm extremely in show lighting.
Sure.
I'm very, I know my way around. But, the kind of lighting that makes a restaurant the right atmosphere or makes a bar the right atmosphere, and it's a different wattage and a different kind of color and temperature to the area that you'd be coming in where you would be, at the box office. And so, there are probably 20, 30 different grades of light or more, to be honest, to create the right atmosphere. And so the detail is phenomenal. And we've had Fisher Dax in New York, who are theater consultants. All of these people top their game. And they do this all the time. They build sports stadiums. They build theaters. And so we had the very best of the best, and with our Hunzinger Construction have been amazing as well. So I'm very fortunate in the joint leadership of the company that I am, that I get the opportunity to work with the very best people who can, endorse decisions, even if I have to end up signing off.
Sure. We are talking with Mark Clements. He's the artistic director at the Milwaukee Rep. And we're going to come back and ask him about some of those shows that they have in that upcoming schedule. If you have any questions, or do you have a favorite show that you've seen at the Milwaukee Rep, we'd love to hear from you. Phone number is 800-642-1234, or you can always send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jill Nadeau. Hope you can join us again tomorrow on the show. Larry's going to be back to talk wildlife with Scott Craven. And then we're going to hear about antibiotic pollution that might be harming our amphibians. That's tomorrow starting at 11 right here on WPR News. Right now we are talking about the Milwaukee Rep. And Mark Clemens, we have some really good shows coming up. We've talked already about Come From Away, and you mentioned It's a Wonderful Life, but we didn't really tell the listeners what this is. Why don't you talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah, It's a Wonderful Life. It's the actual title of the play. It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play. And it's a sort of a group of people putting on a radio version of this amazing story that, you know, many of us connect with, you know, once a year, and offers up a different cautionary tale to life and living it to the full when you can and how you can, because, you know, you don't always know how it's going to unfold. And so it's a and it's a really beautiful piece, this, and it's got Foley in it and a great cast of actors. And I think it'll be just a really an additional lovely holiday kind of little jewel to have with, you know, to coincide with Christmas Carol, which is our, you know, our 50th anniversary this year.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Now, are you concerned that you are competing with a Christmas Carol when you have two Christmas shows?
No, you know, I mean, any more than the Nutcracker and, you know, there are some other things. I feel like sometimes it does feel like we're competing with ourselves, but, you know, we have very distinct audiences, and actually both shows are booking incredibly well, you know, and they're very different. One is very much a family entertainment. Well, they both are, really, I guess. But, you know, some people love to see Christmas Carol every year, and, you know, very proud. I mean, I know people have seen it for all 50, you know, and but there are also people who go, you know, I saw it. I do Christmas Carol one year, and then I do Nutcracker another, and then I do something else another.
Sure.
And I think this is also a piece that transcends just being a holiday show as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very entertaining piece of theater in the way they put this. Is funny, and it's kind of sort of tapping into retro charm, you know, on a, maybe at a time when things were a little calmer and kinder in the world.
And when you're talking about Foley, for those who don't know, that's the sound effects, which people find so amazing when you're watching that live. I've done that show myself a few times, and, you know, people are like, "What? It's people reading, right?" It's like, oh no, you forget about that the first 5 minutes, right?
Yeah. And, you know, there's different ways of how you know, the director's approach. I know that Jonathan Pettit, who's our artistic producer at the theater, he's also directing this, and he's super excited by the cast he's got, and so I think people are in for a real treat.
Oh yeah, it's fun. And then we've talked about the Christmas Carol, but then coming up also in the beginning of next year, you've got The Fisherman's Daughter. Now that's a musical, and it's set in Wisconsin. Tell us more about that one.
Yeah, so it's set up in the Door County area. It's this show that was made by the company Northern Sky, who do a lot of local stories and have created, you know, they're the guys who created Guys on Ice and My Dad's Season Tickets and those sort of things. So Fisherman's Daughters is this really, you know, heartwarming, was sort of made for Wisconsin musical, and it's with touching songs and, you know, very much homegrown humor that people who know that part of the world are very fond, you know, fond of, and it's a very Wisconsin thing. And
I think is that going to be in the Stackner, Mark?
It is. Yeah. And that just that opens just after the new year on January 9th, I think. So yeah.
And another one that you're directing is McNeil. Now, the previews on the website say that the audience is going to see jaw-dropping projections and special effects. Can you kind of give us a little bit of a hint as to what to expect for that one?
Yeah, so this play is really interesting and will kind of for the size of that space will kind of be something that nobody's ever seen before from a tech point of view. McNeil is by Pulitzer Prize winning a Milwaukee native theater actor. And we're the only theater in America that has done all of his works, and including I'm currently co-adapting American Dervish, which was Ayer's first novel with him, for the stage, which will probably not be next year, but the year after, as a premiere. But McNeil is a regional premiere. It was done with Robert Downey Jr. in the title role at the Lincoln Center and broke all records. And it's really a play. Well, it's hard to say what it's about, but it's a writer who is accused of plagiarism and the intersection of how we use AI. And so it's kind of a very bold project. It involves a lot of tech about with AI, how we distinguish between reality and what is AI. And as this kind of medium becomes incrementally more, exponentially more sophisticated day on day, I mean, I feel like AI is running faster than we as a society can keep up with it. And it's also specifically about a playwright, in this case, a novelist who's writing a book that is accused of plagiarism. But it's like, how do we differentiate between when a work is being plagiarized and when was it copied, stolen, or how was it heavily influenced? And so, you know, there's an example in the play where Shakespeare takes King Lear from another play very closely titled King Lear, and takes the idea of a play, but spins it into the genius work that we still perform 400 years later. So was that plagiarism or was it kind of influence? And as artists, you know, anyone who works in the arts or in the creative fields, we're all influenced by people. You know, if I think about what I was influenced by as a young director, the books that I was reading, the directors and the writers that I was watching, you know, their work is absolutely in my DNA, part of my DNA now. But there's a difference between, as most students will know, who now have their theses run through AI programs, is that, you know, there's a difference between, like, literally copying somebody's work word for word. And I think that's going to become more of a thing. You know, you've seen it in the music industry. Is that, you know, those sequence of chords, are they stolen from somebody who can categorically approve they wrote it before that other person that made a lot of money and were famous out of it? So it deals with a lot of those kind of things.
Absolutely. And one of the things I've always loved about The Rep is that you have such a variety of shows. I mean, they appeal to almost everybody. And because I've always had faith in what you've chosen, I have been introduced to some things that I probably wouldn't have done on my own to go out to see. What's the process like when you select all of these shows?
Cool. Yeah, it's the hardest thing. You know, we're actually a few days away of securing what the following season will be, believe it or not. Oof. And you know, it gets down to the nitty gritty of crunching it and budgeting it. And do we think how many people will come and see it? And what could we do with it? Who could we work with? Which formulates the budget. I mean, as you say, we are quite a broad church. We are not a theater that just does musicals, but we do musicals. We're not a theater that does new work, but we do a lot of new work. We try to do a new piece in each space. Each year, each season. So, you know, we try to make sure that we have diversity, cultural, racial, artistic variation. And also because we're a subscription theater, a subscription is a great way of doing exactly what you just said, Joe, you know, which was, hey, I don't know about this play, but I've got a subscription. Maybe I add it to my 5, my 7, my 11, 12 shows, whatever. And you actually see something extraordinary. Yes. For me, the holy grail of going to the theater or a concert, the best case scenario is go in with a low expectation or zero, and come out having experienced a shared experience, a seminal experience in your life that you'll never forget, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's just, that's the great thing about just whether it's a gallery or, an exhibition or a concert, where it just blows you away and you can't get over it. And that's amazing. And what we try to do is to look for opportunity within the subscription season to bring people to a different kind of work. So, you know, when I started introducing musicals to the main stage in 2010, when I came on as artistic director, there were a lot of people who were quite angry. You know, they said, we don't like musicals. That's why we come to the rep. We don't like musicals. And then they would see something like my version of Cabaret or Assassins or Dreamgirls or Ragtime and would end up, you know, would end up kind of being, you know, just very, like, excited by it.
Yeah. Well, I do have to say that I did see your version of West Side Story. You did direct that, right?
I did, yeah.
That was amazing to me. I've seen so many versions, and everything was just perfect. So from the sets to the costumes to the singing to the choreography, everything just... It was just amazing, and I will remember that forever. How do you feel when that all comes together like that?
Yeah, I mean, that West Side Story was my starting point for that, specifically as you mentioned it, mm-hmm. was I had seen that show a lot of times in my life, but yeah. I had never seen it how I'd hoped to see it. So when I got, I chose to direct it and we got the opportunity to do it. I was like, I want to do it how I'd always wanted to do it. So, for example, one thing, it's a very demanding score, right? Vocally
yes.
and dance-wise, acting-wise. So it's the ultimate triple threat kind of experience, as they say. And I wanted to make sure that those actors were really young. And not like actors who were in their late 30s. Not that that's not young, but you know, we're looking at gang people who were 17, 20, maybe 15 yes. in some cases. And there's somehow an enhanced tragedy in that story when you're looking at very young people involved. So we were like, we had a ton of people in that show who were straight out of drama school and untried, untested, and doing that show 8 times a week. But I think that was something how as a way in. So I'm always looking, like Come From Away is done in a particular way, and people love that. And we're not going to be reinventing the wheel on it, mm-hmm. but we come from it is definitely going to, the aesthetic of that is going to be look and feel very different from anything you've seen anywhere else before, I would say. So I'm kind of excited about trying to take an idea, a bit like we said with McNeil, take an idea which is maybe not yours or not original, but adding something to it, enhancing it, and presenting it in a different way that is just as captivating for people.
And that's kind of the whole thrill of theater, is to see something presented in a different way. And every night's different, obviously. So we've gotten through, you've got such a huge show. You're very ambitious this year. You've got so many shows going on.
Year.
Oh, my gosh. So besides McNeil, we've got the Lehman Trilogy. Which we had kind of mentioned before. We've got August Wilson's. Now, you've been doing a number of August Wilson's. You've got The Piano Lesson this year, which is really wonderful. And then for, again, music, Ain't Misbehavin', Fats Waller musical show. And Frida, A Self-Portrait. Now, that's an interesting show itself. But talk a little bit about that one.
Yeah, it's like an extraordinary show by Vanessa, who wrote it as well as performs it, about Frida Kahlo, the famous artist. And it's just the way Vanessa Severo, her name is, and she just how she portrays facets of Frida's Life, and it's directed beautifully by Joni Schultz, who's the associate artistic director at Cincinnati Players in the Park, who we work with a lot, and she created this show with Vanessa. It is an hour, 15-minute play, no intermission, and just delves into facets of Frida's life that we might not know about, or just kind of goes into greater detail about, you know, that how she had a hand disability, and as indeed does Vanessa in real life. So that's how Vanessa had originally connected with Frida, and the kind of who was an actor and then had a desire to write and portray her, and ended up writing this thing herself. And you know, this has been performed at numerous theaters, and this will be the second show in the new Harrow Frankie studio, which is going to be gorgeous. And I do want to say for people, you know, it's like the seats are going to be just more comfortable from an accessibility point of view. You know, if you had to leave in the show, you had to walk in front of everybody. Now there's exits out the back, and it's just going to be
wonderful.
The bar, the furniture is going to be beautiful.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for coming by and spending an hour of your time with us to tell us what's going on at the Milwaukee Rev.
Yeah, thank you, Joe. Great questions as well. Thank you.
Thank you. And so there's more shows that we didn't even cover, so go to the website, milwaukeerep.com, and, you know, just see what they're doing. I want to thank everybody on the team for helping us create these shows, Clara Neipert, Joel Patenaud, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, and, of course, Larry Mueller, which will be back tomorrow. Thanks for staying with us. Have a great day.